This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the first woman to hike all 11 National Scenic Trails just accomplished her goal here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to her about her time on the Ice Age Trail and what's next. Now, President Biden spent 4 days on a diplomatic trip through the Middle East late last week and into the weekend, meeting with leaders of Israel and Saudi Arabia, among others. Biden said the trip was an effort to strengthen relations in the region in opposition to Iran, China, and Russia. The president is facing some criticism domestically for his handling of Israel and Saudi Arabia because of concerns over human rights. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you follow President Biden's trip to the Middle East? Do you think it's important for him to build better relations with these countries? Do you think he handled the trip well? What would you like to see gone differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nahal Tusi is a senior correspondent for Foreign Affairs and National Security at Politico. Nahal, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What stood out to you the most about this presidential visit to the Middle East?
Well, I guess it had to be the fist bump. I really hate to admit that. I mean, it seems like you would think I'd talk about policy or something like that. But honestly, just seeing that visual of President Biden giving a fist bump to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, that really did stand out for me. And it's the visual that I'm going to keep with me for a long time.
Let's give a listen to President Biden addressing Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman, talking about the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. We don't have that audio. Okay. Well, the president had said back in 2019 he would make Saudi Arabia a pariah. Use the word pariah over human rights violations, including the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. Now here he is. How could you? And that's the significance, I think, of that fist bump. How did he try to thread that needle?
Yeah, look, it just basically came down to reality, right? Which is that there are certain countries at certain times that the United States feels that it will need for advancing its national interest. And the Biden administration sees Saudi Arabia as a critical partner, as have plenty of presidential administrations in the past in the Middle East. And it's not just because of oil and the price shocks that we've been experiencing because of Russia's war on Ukraine, but also because of the regional threat posed by Iran and the literal central location of that country in a place where the food security situation has an impact. And the Chinese and Russian interest, of course, in maintaining relations with the Saudis. So, you know, it's a country that's been a partner for a long time. And yes, it does have this de facto ruler with a lot of blood on its hands. But the sense of the Biden administration was, after all this time, that, look, we just have to engage them one way or another. And you could also argue that ignoring them doesn't really help advance the cause of human rights either. That if you engage them and talk to them and say, hey, maybe you should stop killing journalists, that maybe that'll have more impact than just declaring them a pariah and trying not to deal with them.
You wrote a piece recently on Mohammed bin Salman, looking at whether he had changed as a ruler, whether he could get, I guess, better from a human rights perspective over time. What kind of things are you looking at?
Yeah, I mean, look, this guy, he's in his 30s. And the first time I wrote about him was actually back in 2015 when he was the deputy crown prince. And he had just kind of come out of nowhere. And everybody was like, who is this guy? But he'd already, you know, been launching a war in Yemen and doing these things. And everyone really in Washington, really nobody knew who he was. And now he's basically running Saudi Arabia, although his father is still the king, but his father is quite old and the son is doing all the work. And he's so young that, you know, there is a sense in Congress and beyond that he could be around for another 50 years and we have to learn to deal with him and we have to understand what he's like and how or whether we can shape him. But the interesting thing is it's hard to say if you can shape him because now he's what, in his mid to late 30s. He's never actually really, he's never lived outside Saudi Arabia, unlike a lot of many other Arab elites who get their schooling in the West. They, you know, go to places like Harvard and Georgetown. They get these slots. Mohammed bin Salman went to university in Saudi Arabia. He doesn't have as much exposure to the West. And so he doesn't seem to quite understand why people react the way they do when he does things like abduct the Prime Minister of Lebanon, which he did a few years ago. So, you know, it's like there's a disconnect. And the question is, has he, after the backlash over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi and the, you know, temporary freeze out under the Biden administration, has he learned a lesson? Does he know he can, can he change, basically? Can he become a more responsible ruler? And, you know, what some people tell me is, you're not really going to change his personality that much at this stage, but he does seem to be more respectful of process. He does seem to be more understanding that his actions will have consequences. And you have to remember, this is a guy who grew up a Saudi royal, you know, clearly a favorite son. He could get away with just about anything growing up. And now it's clear that on the global stage, he can't just get away with it. Although you could argue that Biden going there and seeing him and giving him a fist bump and maybe makes him think he can get away with it.
And you mentioned that Saudi Arabia isn't important just because of oil, but the oil is pretty important. And we've got the situation now with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. High oil prices help Russia and hurt the West. And one hope from Biden's visit, I think, was to get Saudi Arabia to push for more expansion of oil, bring down those prices, hurt Russia, help the West. Did anything come out of that?
Actually, no. I mean, nothing major. And that's one of the amazing things. Look, a while ago, the Saudis and some of the Arab states agreed to have some limited increase in production. And it seems like that's basically about it. And so we did not hear any new agreement on expanded production or anything coming out of this Biden trip. And that's partly because, from what we're told, you know, the Saudis, they only have so much capacity to increase anyway. Like, it's not like they necessarily are doing it out of or not doing it out of spite. There are certain limitations. And so, no, there actually was not some major breakthrough on energy. Now, it is possible there were other steps that were made, things behind the scenes that really could matter over time, and that maybe we just don't know yet. But no, I mean, in terms of a big deal that could like affect the high oil prices and things, no, we haven't really seen anything like that.
We're talking to Nehal Tusi, national security correspondent at Politico, looking at President Biden's four-day trip to the Middle East. You could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from the White House when it comes to Saudi Arabia? How about Israel? Are you paying attention to the latest news in the Middle East, or is all your foreign policy oxygen, like a lot of the media, being sucked up by what's going on in Russia and Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Nehal, that was Saudi Arabia. Another big visit was to Israel, and the current leadership of Israel, subject to change, I think, pretty soon, with another in a series of elections on the way. Can you talk about that meeting?
Yes. The Israelis love to boast that they are the only real democracy in the Middle East, and they are definitely proving it with all these elections that they're having. They're about to have a fifth in less than 4 years. President Biden went to Israel first. It was a really key part of the trip. And actually, in many ways, Israel is the big winner from this entire trip. Throughout the Biden administration, Israel has basically gotten everything that it wanted, nearly everything. The Biden administration, either because it can't legally or politically, it's just too explosive, it has been unable to reopen the consulate that dealt with the Palestinians. It has not been able to revive the nuclear deal with Iran, something that Israel opposes. There's just been so many steps. And even the meeting with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia was actually a victory for Israel, because Israel really wants the U.S. and Saudi Arabia to get along better, because it is trying to improve its ties to Saudi Arabia, and in the hopes that over time it can establish diplomatic relations with them. So overall, yeah, I mean, Joe Biden went there. He was received very well. And it was, he loves Israel. He's always been a diehard Israel supporter. And they received him with a lot of happiness. And it went quite well for him. And yeah, for the Israelis, this was a really great trip.
And a key country here that didn't get a visit is Iran. Israel, Saudi Arabia, other Sunni-led countries very worried about Iran's influence, agenda in the region. How central was Iran in these meetings?
Oh, man, the day that a U.S. president goes to Iran, that will be a seismic shift. But no, Iran is definitely not getting a presidential visit anytime soon. It remains the number one adversary in the Middle East in the eyes of the U.S., as well as in the eyes of the Israelis and many of its Arab partners. Iran, in many ways, has become a unifying factor, kind of the common enemy that has united Arab states with Israel. And yeah, it's continuing to, you know, cause all sorts of issues. It has a number of proxy militias and militant groups and terrorist organizations that it supports throughout the Middle East. It continues with its nuclear program, although that is a complicated issue. And so, yeah, it's still considered a major threat. And the U.S. has not been able to convince it to revive the nuclear deal that it had struck a few years back and which President Trump abandoned. So yes, Iran remains a major concern. I don't see any major breakthroughs though coming with that. I mean, I don't know what the plan is. And I do, believe me, I ask a lot. That's a question I ask a lot of US officials in Washington. Hey, what's the plan? And you know, often I just don't get an answer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Neenah. Brian, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, the optics of the fist bump, I don't sanction everything that led up to, you know, the killing or anything like that, obviously. But, you know, so much attention has been paid to this fist bump, and we hope that we are going to find some return that's going to ultimately help our country. At the same time, I don't hear any of those voices reflecting back to when we gave legitimacy to Kim Jong-un, where there was genocide in the entire country, yet we went there for optics only. And we got nothing out of it. So I'm curious as to your speaker and comparing the two.
Brian, thanks for the call. Brian, I think referring to President Trump's high-profile meeting with Kim Jong-un. You wrote, I think, in your MBS piece about President Trump and the orb in his Saudi Arabia visit. Compare and contrast, Nihal.
Yeah, look, those were very both very important visits. I mean, the Kim Jong-un visits were historic. I mean, unprecedented. No U.S. president, sitting U.S. president, had ever sat down with, met with a North Korean leader. And it was a wild shot by President Trump in hopes of breaking some taboos and trying to make some headway. He would argue, President Trump would, that he actually did lower the temperature with North Korea and that we did get something out of it, which was we were, you know, on the verge of like some pretty heated moments with North Korea initially under President Trump, but that most of the rest of his term, like, things calmed down and the North Koreans didn't really make too much noise. So, I mean, he would argue that there was something out of that. Now, I remember, I will tell you this, I personally wrote a number of stories about the human rights element of that trip and how when President Trump went there and met him and they acted like they were best friends. They met in Singapore, just to be clear, initially, that it was a real blow to the human rights efforts, especially because there were so many people who are held in gulags or otherwise being poorly treated in North Korea, which is closest thing that the world has to a totalitarian state. So yeah, no, look, there was a lot of coverage of that. I think it's given how much coverage there was of everything, it might be hard to kind of remember all of that at the same time. But no, there are definite parallels. I will say, I think the Saudi Arabia is much more integrated into the world economy, though, than North Korea is. And so there's a huge difference there.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about President Biden's trip to the Middle East this weekend with Politico senior foreign affairs correspondent Nihal Tusi. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think about President Biden's meeting with Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman? Do you think the president should have been more publicly firm about concerns with the Saudis and human rights issues? Do you want to see the U.S. have a better relationship with Saudi Arabia? How about Israel? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Nihal Tusi, senior foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. With us today, looking at the impacts of President Biden's weekend trip to meet with leaders in the Middle East. A lot of focus on Saudi Arabia and on Israel. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want the U.S. to handle its relations in the Middle East? How important do you think this region is for U.S. global interests? What question do you have about this visit? Do you want to see more support for Israel or less? What about the Palestinians, Saudi Arabia? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nahal, something you touched on earlier, the White House has made the case that, hey, if we're not there in the Middle East, the Chinese and the Russians certainly will be. What kind of diplomatic efforts do you see from Russia and China in the region?
Oh, well, there's always ongoing outreach to those countries. I mean, they have important ties. There's visits and, you know, the diplomats are always in touch. They're always looking for Chinese in particular. They're always looking for trade deals. Forgive me. There's constant ongoing outreach with the countries, but it's also in terms of weapon sales and things like that. And I think that's, you know, all of those are areas where the U.S. does not want to lose the Arab states to the orbit of those other countries. And part of it is actually because we want to sell them weapons as well. So those things all do factor in. I think it's going to be, you know, in many ways, the whole setup they have over there, especially when it comes to their weapons, is kind of configured to be more compatible with the West and the United States. So it's hard for them to simply pivot and, you know, turn to Chinese and Russian made efforts on everything. But it's not impossible. And they are, again, they are oil wealthy countries. They're trying to sell their oil. So if China in particular wants to buy more oil, they're going to do it. They're going to sell them the oil. I mean, it is part of it's just business.
Now, a big part of the story here, and you've touched on this as well, Nahal, the Abraham Accords. Now, this is a diplomatic effort under the Trump administration, kind of one-to-one agreements between Israel and particular Arab countries in the Middle East. This is something that the Biden administration is maybe trying to build on from their predecessor. One of the few cases, foreign or domestic, where they're trying to build on something from the Trump administration.
Yes, that's right. These accords established diplomatic relations between Israel and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice.
That's okay. We all been there.
and Sudan and Morocco. And yeah, the Biden administration says that it's trying to build on these things. They're trying to get more countries to sign on to these accords. I've heard everything from Indonesia to the Comoros, to Oman and beyond. But honestly, I'm a little surprised they haven't gotten another country yet. I don't think the Saudis are going to sign on anytime soon. That doesn't mean that they're not going to take steps to kind of get closer to Israel de facto. You know, they might do things like, I mean, for instance, they did just open their skies to Israeli planes, right? So they're going to, I think the Saudis will do certain things, but officially, are they going to sign a piece of paper? I don't think that'll happen anytime soon. But there might be other countries that in the next year or so, we could see officially sign on. It remains to be seen.
Talking to Nahal Tusi, senior correspondent for foreign affairs and national security at Politico, looking at President Biden's four-day visit in the Middle East late last week and into the weekend. Big meetings with leaders in Saudi Arabia and Israel, looking at what happened, what was said, what, if anything, the U.S. got out of it. You can join in, still a little time, at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Superior. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Saying the stop in Israel and the talks about strengthening ties, everybody knows it's common sense of why he went over there. The stop in Israel was just kind of like a little side shoot to the fact that he was going over to Saudi Arabia with his hand out to beg for oil from foreign entities, because he doesn't want to own the mistakes of completely trying to block all natural resource production and oil in the United States to try to get rid of it in the United States. But yet, let's go beg foreign countries for it. It's absolutely pathetic.
Bill, thanks for the call. Oil production is still pretty high here in the U.S., Nahal, but how much of this was handout begging for more oil?
You know, I mean, they say that it wasn't as much about oil as we, you know, the observers believe that it was. The administration really downplayed the oil aspect of it. But I think it was pretty clear that that is a big part of it. I mean, the high oil prices are affecting President Biden's poll figures. And, you know, the domestic politics aspect of this is huge. But that being said, yes, the U.S. remains, last I checked, it's the top oil producer in the world. And that hasn't changed. It's just that the war in Ukraine has just nonetheless affected confidence affected prices. And frankly, you know, oil companies like are using this moment to make money. And I think that's one of the frustrations that the Biden administration has as well, is they just feel like the oil companies could take steps to lower the prices on their own, that they don't have to be raking in all these profits. But look, yeah, he went there. Oil was a factor, even despite his efforts to deny that or downplay it. But did they get some big oil deal out of it? No. And can the Gulf states really ramp up their production that much more to make much of a difference? My understanding is that they really can't. I mean, just because you have a bunch of oil does not mean that you can actually just, you know, put it on the market the next day. It's actually super complicated. It depends on everything from the type of oil to the refineries, to your capacity, to the people, the amount of money. I mean, it's expensive and it's hard, and it's a very, very intense and complicated field. And so I don't get the sense that he had that much luck, but the administration also has a long-term view of this. I mean, this isn't just about today or tomorrow. I mean, they're thinking, they're hoping for a second Biden term. So they want to think long-term about the relationship as well.
Thanks for that call. And just our last half minute, Nihal, what are you watching for next?
That's a good question. I guess I can tell you I'm going to keep an eye on human rights issues in the Middle East and in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and some of these countries that the U.S. is reaching out to. I'm going to see, now that there has been this outreach, what is Mohammed bin Salman going to do? Is he going to release some political prisoners, or are we going to continue to see ongoing crackdowns? I can't say that I am hopeful given their track record, but anything is possible.
Nihal, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nihal Tusi, senior correspondent for foreign affairs and national security at Politico. She was with us today to share what we learned from President Biden's meetings this weekend in the Middle East, especially his visits to Saudi Arabia and Israel along the way. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some plastics are easier to recycle than others. Find out why recycling programs are often struggling to keep up with the never-ending flow of plastic waste. And you could join in with your questions, maybe your own observations. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, ice cover on the Great Lakes has been going down in recent years. We'll talk to the creator of a big new project looking at the lakes in the winter. Now, more hikers are trying to complete through hikes of Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail. The 1,000-mile journey is a big accomplishment. Fewer people have attempted to finish all 11 national scenic trails in the United States. Our next guest accomplished that goal last week when she walked the final steps of the Ice Age Trail in Sturgeon Bay. Arlette Lahn is a hiking guide with Red Lion Guiding in New Hampshire. She's now the first known female hiker to complete all the national scenic trails. In the hiking world, her trail name is Apple Pie. Arlette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Now, you obviously love hiking. When did you get the idea to say, all right, I'm going to do all the scenic trails around the country?
So I started hiking, long distance hiking in 2003 in California on the Pacific Crest Trail. And just slowly kind of hiked trails that I wanted to hike. And then I found out there was more and more trails. And then there's national scenic trails and a whole list of them. And then I talked to this gentleman. His trail name is Nimblewheel Nomad. And he was like, wow, you only have like 4 left to complete them all. And that was in 2018. And I was like, oh, maybe I should finish them all. And he's like, yeah, you could be the first woman to do them all. I'm like, that'd be kind of cool. So then I was looking at which ones I had left, and I started to tackle those. And I mean, one of the longest ones, the North Country Trail, was in there, and that was a hard one to do. But yeah, then I started working on finishing them up, and then the Ice Age Trail was the last one, and I just finished that up, Monday? Yeah, last week.
Now, I'll admit, I'm a more modest kind of hiker. I'll do a couple-hour loop here and there. Can you talk about the joy of doing this kind of longer-term, end-to-end hike?
For me, what is very appealing about it is it's you see something new every day, and I like the routine of having – it's you get up, you pack up your gear, you go hike. You just think about where's my food, where's my water, and where is my next flat spot to camp. But you do get to see something new every day. So I, for me, that's like a perfect combination of, you know, things that I really enjoy is discovery, but also having that little safety of my little routine and having everything that I need with me. So it's, to me, that's, it's like ideal.
Now, the Ice Age Trail here in Wisconsin, this was the last one. This is the one that completed it for you. I'm not going to say you saved the best for last, but can you share some of the things that you saw, the things you liked about the Ice Age Trail?
I liked that I learned a lot about the glaciers. I mean, like up here where I live near New Hampshire, there's all the boulders and the glacial erratics and all of that. But then on the Ice Age Trail, they make such a focus out of it. Then like have like little displays where it talks about it, or in the guidebook or the maps, it talks about it. So I actually read a little bit more into it. It was like, oh, these potholes are all like formed by these glacial boulders, and there's these eskers. And so it's, you learn a little bit more about it. And that was interesting to me.
What kind of preparation goes into planning out a big through hike?
Depending on the hikes, there is more or less available online. The most important things are finding out where your resupply is. So where's my, where can I get my next supply of food? And some trails, you have to send yourself packages along the way because there is no store, but there's a post office. Or you have to hitchhike to another town to get to a post office because I'm not going to carry like 150 miles worth of food. I mean, I could, but it gets really heavy, you know? So so that kind of logistical planning is the hardest part. And then after that, it's kind of like micro planning. It's like, where's my next tent site and, you know, and all of that stuff? Or where's my next water? All of those things. But the first thing to me is like, how many towns are there and where are they? And do I need to mail myself something?
And part of the fun, I think of hiking like this as maybe a solitary activity, but it sounds like you've gotten to meet a lot of people along the way, other hikers, people in the communities you hike through or past. Do you have some favorite memories?
Yeah, and it depends on the hikes, right? Like, so some of the more popular hikes, you'll see a lot of hikers on the trail. Some of the less popular hikes with through hikers, like the Ice Age Trail, there's more section hikers on it. So I actually really enjoyed meeting people along the way and that were section hiking. And then luckily, like I ran into two sets of women that were like, hey, we live a little bit further along the trail. And so when you come where we live, you can come and hang out at our house and we'll do your laundry and we'll cook for you. And so I got to know more people that live in the areas versus the transient hiker that I am myself. So it was a different connection that I had on the Ice Age Trail. I got to meet more of the locals, which has been a welcome addition to that hiking experience.
And Arlette, as we wrap up, I've got a hunch I know the answer. But having done this big hike, are you going to take a break from hiking for a while?
Not really. I went hiking on Saturday in the White Mountains.
Arlette, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us.
You're welcome.
Arlette Lahn, trail name Apple Pie, recently finished her through hike of the Ice Age Trail, becoming the first woman known to have hiked all 11 national scenic trails in the United States. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about being pregnant during the pandemic.
The pandemic has been hard on many parents. For NJMay Russell Kamara of Milwaukee, her parenting started earlier than she expected when a pregnancy-related illness sent her to the emergency room during the height of the pandemic. Russell Kamara shares her experience as part of the Pandemic Pregnancy Project, which is documenting the stories of families and their babies and how they've been affected by COVID-19.
Every time I'd heard someone who was pregnant experience something that was so severe, I would say to myself, oh, God, that sucks. That better not happen to me. And as soon as I said that, it did. I was in lockdown. And for context, this was the time before vaccines, when people were hogging toilet paper and washing their groceries. Anyway, while working two new jobs from home, I was so nauseous and throwing up every day from week 7 to week 22. My nutrient levels are all over the place. And it's winter time too, which means windows are closed. Every smell is exacerbated, and all I want to do is go anywhere and get fresh air. And I can't because we're in a pandemic and we don't know where the virus is coming from. And given that I had a miscarriage prior, I did not want to risk getting sick. So around week 14, I was listening to a podcast with Amy Schumer, and she was talking about hyperemesis gravidarum and how she landed in the hospital. And I thought, that's not going to happen to me. Well, around week 21, I didn't get enough hydration that morning after being sick the night prior. I turn on the shower, waiting for the water to heat up, and I tell my husband, babe, I'm not feeling good. I had said this so many times before, and all of a sudden, I fall and pass out in his arms, tongue in cheek. And when I come to, I'm on the floor and he's gently slapping me and splashing water in my face. Immediately, we go to the hospital. We're both anxious because that is the last place we wanted to go. We'd gotten so far and staying away from people who could be carrying COVID to now land in that spot with them. And I was so angry, but anxious, because I needed to make sure that our baby was okay and that I was okay. We're sitting in the ER by the windows, finding a seat by the outskirts of a full room. And we're waiting for over 2 hours just to have a bed. Why? Because there were so many COVID patients, there was not enough room for the rest of us. Meanwhile, a woman is vomiting next to me in a paper bag, and it made me nauseous. I could see it, and I still don't know who next to me has COVID. A nurse calls me twice to go into the back room just to check my vitals. Still, I wasn't seen by a doctor, and that cycle happens again. And every time I go back to my seat in the waiting room, I'm paranoid walking through the sea of sick people. Finally, they call my name at the 3-hour mark. I get a bed, and they infuse me with one of those liter bags. I didn't have to pee for a long time. That's how dehydrated I was. They checked my baby's heartbeat, and she was healthy. And long story short, we did not get COVID that day. Today, we're at a time where there are boosters and more boosters, but for many parents, the pandemic is still stressful. Even though my daughter hadn't been born yet, my parenting had already started by doing what I needed to do to protect my health and my mind and my spirit. Yeah, I sure celebrated Mother's Day that May. I mean, even though she wasn't in my arms yet, we had made it so far, and that was worth celebrating.
And Jaime Russell Kamara of Milwaukee shared her story of being pregnant during the pandemic. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a lake expert tells us about his research studying ice decline in the Great Lakes and what it means for life in and near the water. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Ice coverage on the Great Lakes has declined by 71% between the 1970s and 2010s, according to the International Joint Commission. Researchers say that climate change is to blame for the declining ice, which is affecting not only fish and other lake species, but also humans. A big new project called the Winter Grab aimed to measure the impact of changing conditions on the Great Lakes. Ted Ozerski is a large lake biological limnologist and associate professor in the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He organized Winter Grab and the Great Lakes Winter Network. Ted, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the ice cover issue, tell us about the Winter Grab. This is a big project bringing together a lot of researchers. Tell us about the origins.
Yeah, for sure. So we don't know very much about winter on the Great Lakes. It's sort of a bit of a mystery about what the Great Lakes do between November and, let's say, March. So last year, we came together with a bunch of researchers working on different aspects of the Great Lakes ecosystem, and we got some funding from the Cooperative Institute for Great Lakes Research to organize this collaborative sampling campaign. And the Winter Grab was basically an effort by something like 19 organizations in the US and Canada, where over the course of 10 days this past February, all these different groups went to a bunch of different sites around the Great Lakes and collected standardized kinds of samples to understand what the chemistry, physics, and biology of the Great Lakes look like when they're covered by ice.
My understanding is that we used to think that the important stuff in lakes happened from spring to fall, and winter, there's just kind of like in a holding pattern. Turns out, no. Can you talk about what is going on in the lakes in the winter that's important to ecosystems?
Yeah, for sure. So a few things are different about winter than summer. Of course, it's much colder than in the summer. But the other big change that ice cover brings is the amount of light that's reaching the surface of the water. So there's a lot less light in the winter, and that slows some things down that are reliant on that light. But it also, surprisingly, sort of other things are keeping keep chugging along during the winter. Some of the things that are interesting that are happening during the winter are, for example, things like productivity of some algae species that are adapted to this cold water conditions that it turns out are actually high quality food for some of the critters that live in the lakes. Some of the fish reproduce during the winter, so that's important for some of the fish species that are economically important. And also some sort of connections between the water column and the sediment and where the invasive dracinid mussels live are affected by winter conditions as well.
So if we have less ice cover, and it sounds like it has been going down over the decades, what kind of worries does that raise for you?
Yeah, so there's a number of things that people are worried about with declining ice cover. And a lot of these worries are sort of just that, because we really don't know enough about winter to make these projections about what the future will look like with less winter. Some of the concerns around winter is that things like cyanobacterial harmful blooms are going to increase in severity during the summer months. Other concerns have to do with fish. So, for example, there are studies from Lake Michigan and from Lake Erie that show that these warmer, less icy winters affect the reproduction of species like yellow perch and whitefish. But ultimately, really, we don't know quite enough about winter to make these sort of solid projections about what the future holds for us. And that was one of the sort of objectives of Winter Grab, and this increasing interest in winter research is to try and close some of these information gaps that we have about winter.
We're talking to Ted Ozerski from the University of Minnesota Duluth. He studies large lake ecosystems, including the Great Lakes, part of a big Winter Grab project, trying to learn more about what winter means for the Great Lakes and the possible impacts in the future of declining ice cover over the decades. Ted, what surprised you the most out of the data you've pulled together so far from the big winter grab?
I think the thing that surprised me the most is how different parts of the Great Lakes are in the winter. We know that, for example, Lake Superior is quite different from Lake Erie during the summertime. But you might think that in the winter, where things are so cold and there is less light, the lakes might be more similar to each other with less biology going on. But still, they're very, very different. There's a lot of difference in the water chemistry, and there are big differences in the biology as well. And one of the things that these big differences are suggesting is that there is still a lot of exciting biology happening during the winter and under the ice.
Are you hoping to do something like this again so you can start to see change over time in the winter?
That's a great question, Rob. And that's definitely something that we're talking about with our collaborators at the Great Lakes sort of Winter Network. This Winter Grab effort was a one-time project. So we got some funding from the Cooperative Institute for Great Lakes Research to do this. But we're definitely hoping that we can, like you say, do this again and sort of start monitoring this change over time. So we're sort of exploring how we can do this again.
Now, I mentioned that statistic at the outset, 70% or so decline in ice coverage in the Great Lake. This is from averages in the 1970s to the 2010s. I mean, that sounds really big. Are we seeing that much less ice over time?
One of the interesting things about ice on the Great Lakes is how variable it is from year to year. Even before climate change, a very small difference in air temperature from winter to winter would have a big difference. It is very variable. If you look at this graph, you know, you can have 90% ice cover on Lake Superior in 1 year and then 10% ice cover in another year. But if you look at the overall long-term trend, the trend is definitely towards decreasing ice cover. And the change, like you mentioned with this statistic, is pretty dramatic.
Do you have hopes that climate change can be slowed down enough so that that trend line doesn't continue over the next couple of decades?
Good question. I think I have hope, but given our current trajectories and some of the modeling that I've seen for the Great Lakes, it looks pretty likely that by the end of the 21st century, ice cover will be a very rare event on the Great Lakes. So unless something very dramatic changes, I think we're going to keep seeing less and less ice until it almost completely disappears.
As you mentioned, this is a big question mark. If ice cover keeps going down, what it's going to mean for so many of the species we're familiar with, maybe on fish fry, among other things. What are some of the big open questions that you have that you're going to be looking at over the next couple of years when it comes to the impact of declining ice?
I think one of the big open questions, really, in terms of biology, in terms of physics, in terms of chemistry of the Great Lakes, is what does ice itself, the presence of ice and the properties of ice, do for the ecosystem? So here, a lot of the people who are involved, were involved in the winter grab, they're coming from different disciplines. Some of them are physicists, some of them are chemists, some of them are biologists. And sort of the big unifying question is, well, what does it mean if we have no ice, or if we have, you know, 1 month less of ice? So that's, I think, what collectively we are most curious about with this winter work. For me, some of the questions that I'm really interested in is, what does the presence or absence of ice do for the productivity of the Great Lakes in terms of, for example, the growth of phytoplankton or some of the critters that form the base of the food web?
I want to get a sense of what practically was happening over this couple of weeks in winter grab. I understand some of it was really high-tech stuff and some of it, you know, was buckets. Can you talk about the range of activities you did to collect all this data?
For sure. So we created a common protocol for the things that we wanted all the participants to try and collect, and sort of had some safety guidance on how to work in the winter. But it was up to the individual teams to decide where they were going to go and how they're actually going to do the collection. So like you said, it sort of ranged from some people sampling, you know, from a pier using a bucket to some people using an airboat to sample locations in Saginaw Bay, people using snowmobiles. And then some teams worked with the U.S. Coast Guard to collect samples from Coast Guard icebreakers. So it was a pretty big range.
And then you're in Duluth. You're no stranger to cold. But can you talk about, you know, being out on the lakes in the middle, Lake Superior in particular, in the middle of winter, collecting all this stuff?
You know, in some ways, winter work is less challenging than summer work, at least if you have good ice cover, because in the winter you can either drive out if the ice is really thick or sort of walk out on the ice and, you know, set up your ice shelter. And it's actually pretty comfortable and cozy. So you don't have to deal with waves. You don't have to trailer a boat. So if the weather cooperates and it's not too bad, I actually prefer working in the winter than in the summer. But of course, worst case scenario is it's a whiteout blizzard and you just don't want to be out there.
Ted, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me.
That was Ted Ozerski, a large lake biological limnologist and associate professor in the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Wisconsin, Duluth. Ted joined us to talk about his research with winter grab, studying the decline of ice coverage on the Great Lakes, a big effort all over the Great Lakes to collect data about species and ecosystems in the lakes. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new book tells the story of lesser-known figures in American labor history and the impact they had on modern workplaces. Meet the author of Fight Like Hell. And gas prices have gone back down over the last couple of weeks, but they're still high. We'll get the latest on oil, gas, and the impact on inflation. By the way, earlier we talked to someone who'd hiked the Ice Age Trail and all the scenic trails around the U.S. Want to hear your favorite place to hike in Wisconsin? Email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'll share your answers tomorrow on Central Time.